for schools, educators, students and educational developments. Dublin City FM.
Hello and welcome to Inside Education with me, Sean Delaney. Coming up on today's programme.
Teachers should set an example of cleanliness and neatness in their persons and in the state and general appearance of their schools. They should also satisfy themselves by personal inspection every morning that the children have had their hands and faces washed, their hair combed, clothes cleaned and when necessary mended. The school apartments too should be swept and dusted every evening and whitewashed once a year.
Don't worry, that's not an edict from our new Minister for Education and Skills. It is in fact an excerpt from a book written by our guest on the programme today, Susan M. Parks. The book is titled A Guide to Sources for the History of Irish Education 1780 to 1922. And the good news is that the publishers, Four Courts Press, have given us a copy of the book to give away on the programme this evening. To be in with a chance of winning the book, you need to answer the following question. What was the name given to the secret schools that existed in many parts of Ireland to educate Catholics during penal times? You can text your answer along with your name, address and phone number to 086 8962 665. That text number again is 086 8962 665. You can also email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That email address again is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie and you need to enter before 12 noon on Friday the 30th of April. And now we're going to find out more about the book because I spoke to the author Susan Parks during the week. Susan Parks is a Fellow Emeritus of Trinity College and a noted scholar in the history of Irish education. In the book, she includes some local history of education case studies, and I began by asking her why she included the local case studies in the book.
I tried in the book to give an example of how you might use what would be general sources for the study of a local history. Of course, in a local study, the first and most important thing really are the records which are in the local schools. And these are invaluable, and one of the things I would hope very much the book would do is to encourage schools to look after and to look treasure their records. This would include the school registers, the report book, the attendance book, the punishment book which they had, which the teachers had to sign, because these records show the life of the community in the school. So there are those sort of records when you're starting to do a local study. But then in addition to that, there are many general national records which you can draw on to enhance and find out more about your local study. For example, there is a very fine commission in 1825, which is called the Irish Education Inquiry. And it was done, a survey done, a national survey by the government before the introduction of the national school system. And what they did was they did a survey of every parish in Ireland. They asked the Protestant clergy and they asked the Catholic clergy both to return all the schools which they knew in the area, who the schoolmaster or schoolmistress was, how many children were in attendance, what the schoolhouse was like, whether it received any aid from the local community, and whether the Bible was read. And this census, in a way, is available for every parish in Ireland and is a very, very good way to start a local study because you get all the hedge schools, the old pay schools that were there before the national school system came along. You get schools founded by churches, you get schools founded by education societies, and you get landlord schools. So anybody starting to look at a local area, this 1825 commission, which is in the British Parliamentary Papers, is an invaluable starting point.
And your book goes from 1780 to 1922, Susan. I wonder, could you say a little bit about what education was like in 1780?
Yes, what the book really studies is basically the 19th century, but particularly the growth of a state system of education, state support, state aided. Before, if you go back to 1780, you're really talking about the power of the education system was in the hands of the established church, that would be the Church of Ireland. And the Catholic community were only just beginning to emerge out of penal period. So you had a very large number of small voluntary schools, some of which were run by the Protestant Church, but many of them would be run by individual schoolmasters or schoolmistresses. And that was the
And who would they have been, the schoolmasters and schoolmistresses?
Well, they would have been self-educated. There's a whole study which has been on hedge schoolmasters. And they were a self-perpetuating group of people. They very often went, it was a local commute school with a local master who might teach English, and he might teach Latin sometimes, or Greek. And if you see the play by Brian Friel, Translations, which is about a local hedge school, the points come out very well of how people went to them. They were out of doors, they were very simple, they didn't have many schoolhouses, and in the beginning, of course, they were illegal, so they were covert. But they developed eventually into a widespread, and boys and girls went to the schools, particularly if they wanted to learn English, or if they wanted to learn to read and write in any way. But it was mostly English, and then some of them taught the classics. And one schoolmaster, when he was become educated, he would pass on his skills to the next generation. So it's a very interesting but not very well documented.
And when you say they were taught outside, I mean, with Irish weather, that doesn't sound
very
practical.
Yes, no, it wasn't. It isn't. But that's why they were called hedge schools, because initially they were clandestine, because the Catholic community, Catholics were not supposed to be schoolmasters. So, under the penal laws. So what they did was they would meet together perhaps in a hedge, on the sunny side of the hedge. They would have some books, and if anybody, a stranger or some seen snooping around, they would disperse, and they would hide the books, and they would go and pick the potatoes or whatever they were doing. Gradually what happened was people in the community would give the schoolmaster a roof over his head. And he might come for 3 months, and then he might move on to another place. But they didn't have any schoolhouses, per se. So you're talking about a voluntary indigenous education system. Now, what happens then in the 19th century is that the state begins to want to offer aid and also wants to control much more what the children are learning. So that you're beginning to get the idea of citizenship and citizens. And particularly once you get 1829, which is the year that the Catholic Emancipation, Daniel O'Connell, the British government is very aware that what the children are going to learn in school ought to be what they think they should learn in school, which is one of the reasons why the national school system, which we still have today, was set up in 1831.
And what was the impetus for setting up the national school system? Is it those things you've mentioned, like this growing awareness of citizenship and the nation state? Is that it?
Well, that's one side of it, which is the control, social control side, which most states actually, and particularly across Europe, once you move into the era where you're beginning to get everybody wanting to learn to read and write, before that, that's not true. What happens in the 19th century is you get growth of mass literacy, which means that everyone begins to learn to read and write, which creates a whole new political dimension of people who can read and people who can think and to vote for themselves. So the government's very keen to do that. But one of the difficulties about the system prior to the national school system was proselytizing, which is that their churches had used, particularly the Anglican Church, had used the education system to proselytize, to try to convert children to a particular religious faith. Now, the government was aware of the fact that if they were going to set up a state system, it must be a-religious. In other words, the two communities, the Catholic and the Protestant community, should be able to go to the same school, but that their religious traditions wouldn't be changed. So the Catholic Church was very dissatisfied with the fact that the Protestant Church was getting a lot of state money subsidizing these Protestant schools. And they said, we should have some state money. So the government of the day, and it was Lord Stanley, who was the chief secretary, who came in 1830, what he set up basically was a system whereby there was to be combined secular and moral instruction, where the children would go to a national school and they would get their secular instruction. But at a certain time in the day, they would separate, and the children would have their own individual religious instruction given by the churches, and that would protect the child. And that is still true in the national school system today, that you can opt out of religious instruction.
In your opinion, has this period, 1780 to 1922, was it a story of continual advancement and improvement of the system, or, you know, was there kind of advances and regressions as it went as it progressed?
Well, if you look at it, you can argue, yes, that it was a period of progress, because basically what you gain by the end of the beginning of the 20th century is that the majority of people in the country have become literate and they can read and write. And that in itself is a major social change for the whole period. It was a very stormy period of history, and that's what makes it so interesting, because throughout the 19th century you have this struggle, underlying struggle, between the churches and the state as to who is going to finally get control of the education system. And you will get a great deal of issues where the church will carry very strongly. Now, one, for example, area was teacher education. If we look at that. The national board, the government board, had a college in Marlborough Street, which is where the minister's office is now. And that was a non-denominational college for national school teachers. Now, by the 1860s, the Catholic Church had said, we will not allow any student who has been trained in this college to teach in a Catholic national managed Catholic national school. We want a Catholic training colleges for the control of the teachers. You see, national school teachers were all lame people. They weren't cleric, they weren't religious. And therefore, the formation and the training of these teachers is crucial. So they stood out, and eventually the government eventually recognised what we call denominational teacher education, which is like St Patrick's in Drumcondra, Mary Eye in Limerick, and Carisford College in Black Rock, and the Protestant community have the Church of Ireland College. So your teacher education became denominational, and that was one of the major struggles, which... And it's interesting because it's coming up again now about the religious education of teachers, because there is no state secular training college. It was closed in 1922.
Susan, a lot of what you're saying is very much in that political sphere and policy sphere. Do we know much about the practice of teaching in this period? What went on in the classroom between the teacher and the children and the subjects that they were teaching?
Yes. It's possible to reconstruct really what life was like in a school using a lot of the contemporary records. We have core curriculums laid down, so we have quite an idea of what the children were meant to be learning, what they were studying. It's also possible to look at textbooks which have survived, because the National Board published its own set of readers which were really covered all the different subjects, and they lasted for a large proportion of the 19th century. You can also look at teachers' method books, which we have one. One very interesting one is by P.W. Joyce, who is better known for his Irish place names, but he was what was called the master of method in the Marlborough Street Training School, and he wrote a very, very good book about how to teach, how to organise teach maths, how to teach reading, how to teach... And you can find from that many ways in which the methods of the school... We also have, and it's in the book here, I was going to just call the 12 practical rules for teachers of national schools. And these were written in the 1840s, and they survived really through the whole of the 19th century, 20th century. And they tell us more about the kind of hidden curriculum of the school, of the fact that the school was meant to encourage social, helping one another, looking after animals, being kind to people, respecting other people's religious faith. That's the different one. And then it tells us the kind of thing that the teachers would like. So perhaps I'll just read you a little bit
there. Sure, that'd be very interesting.
This is the teacher now. The teacher should promote, both by precept and example, cleanliness, neatness, and decency. To effect this, teachers should set an example of cleanliness and neatness in their persons, and in the state and general appearance of their schools. They should also satisfy themselves by personal inspection every morning that the children have had their hands and faces washed, their hair combed, clothes cleaned, and when necessary, mended. The school apartments, too, should be swept and dusted every evening and whitewashed once a year. Now, that's the cleanliness, one of the hidden curriculum and points of view that the national school, the local schools, is teaching the children to be public health. And the teacher has got to be a person who is setting a very good example. They also were not allowed to live over in a public house. They had to put forward the best moral principles, like truth and honesty were two of the ones which were very strongly emphasized. And the teachers were very carefully, they had to avoid fairs, markets and meetings, and above all, political meetings, because they were not to be seen to be attached to one side or the other.
The focus of your book, Susan, is on sources, and I'm wondering how many of the sources are available online, or do scholars who want to consult them, do they need to do a lot of legwork in order to be able to find them?
Well, there are really two different major sources for history of education. One is the ones that are official papers and official documents, policy documents. And they are mostly available in national, for example, in the National Archives. It's a very good, wonderful education records where you can go. And increasingly, they're not yet online. As you know, the census has been put online. But in the next 10 years, increasingly, National Archives will begin to make more and more material available online. Also, the British Parliamentary Papers, which are most of the major, like the National Library and the University Libraries, have copies. They are now online through a library. And they contain the annual reports of all the agencies that were set up to do education, like the National Board, the Intermediate Board that ran the secondary school systems, the universities, the Queen's Colleges, which were set up in the 1840s, technical education, which came in the 1900. These are all government agencies, and they published an annual report every year. So we know everything we need to know about them. And they are now online, and that is remarkable asset for teachers for researchers to be able to get at, particularly. There are also then, where you really have to start to look is local, to look at local authorities who have quite a number of records of their schools, local communities where the school records have been kept, and to look for those in local community areas. And that is more difficult because sometimes they're there and sometimes they're not. So in a sense, it's sometimes easier to access the big policy documents. It's more difficult to access the local. But then you have to remember you have local newspapers, you have photographs that people have taken, you have oral memory, very important in local communities, interviewing the people. You have teacher education, people who remember. You have autobiographies. We have a lot of very interesting, the most famous one would have been To School Through the Fields. But there's been a huge, where people reminisce and remember their schooling, and they are invaluable for helping to recreate what it was like to be in school, say 30, 40 years ago.
Although that came up on a previous programme, Susan, where somebody said that very few, especially post-primary teachers, have actually written from their perspectives about education and about teaching.
No, that's quite true. They haven't. Primary sources have written, people have written, they've got Brian McMahon, for example, which is The Master, which is a wonderful book for anyone interested in the way a schoolmaster run. They don't. And it's very interesting because, on the whole, teachers don't tend to write about schools. And it's very interesting. In some ways, they think everybody knows what it's like. That's partly because people have all been there. But you're quite right. And the voice of teachers hasn't been as much heard in research and in the documentation as it could have been. You've got to look for it. And oral memory is very important for the recent years. But if you want to go back, it's very difficult. Sometimes these royal commissions, there were a lot of royal commissions in the 19th century trying to solve the Irish education issues. And in those, you will sometimes get interviews with headmasters of various schools, or inspectors, or teachers. And they, you can reconstruct from them, although they were very formal, they're a question and answer, and they're public. You get the public face of what the teacher's going to say, but you don't get the private one.
Which could be very different.
Which could be very different, yes.
Finally, Susan, I was wondering, say, if a teacher is listening to the programme and they kind of say, well, I can see why it's important to know about psychology or sociology or even philosophy of education, but I'm not so sure where history of education fits in. What argument would you make to a young teacher or to any teacher for the importance of knowing about history of education?
Yes, I've always stood up that it's a very important part of a teacher's, young teacher's opening and entry into the profession. It's a very old profession. We have been educating children for centuries. And in particular, the school system tends to be fairly conservative. And you go into a school, and maybe in 2010, and you wonder why it works the way it does. And it may not be particularly the way you would want it to work. But the fact of the matter is, it's an organic social institution which evolves through the years, and it carries part of its history with it, and it goes into new. It's always dealing with the young. And yet, dealing with the young means that at times it's conservative, because the children, you have to give the children a basis of the society in which they live and the skills which they will need. And you get very radical schools, but generally speaking, the run of schools. Now, to a young teacher going, starting out, it makes you feel part of a very honourable profession, which would be one I'd be very pleased with. It also gives you insight into the way education changes and develops. It's slow, but it does. It's ever-changing. And there are very few new ideas in education that have never been tried. Now, sometimes they worked, and sometimes they didn't. So you can have a look at, you can what. But to understand that if you want to change the education system, which most teachers very often, you have to know where you're starting from and how it works. And that is a great, knowledge is, in my opinion, a great strength when it comes to innovation and change.
Susan Parks's book, A Guide to Sources for the History of Irish Education, 1780 to 1922, is a must-have for anyone who wants to understand Irish education. It is well-written and beautifully produced. It is available in hardback for €45 and paperback for €22.50 from all good bookshops, and also online from www.fourcourtspress.ie. Of course, you can win a copy of the book by entering our competition this week. You need to tell us, what was the name given to the secret schools that existed in many parts of Ireland to educate Catholics during penal times? You can text your answer along with your name, address and phone number to 086 8962 665. That text number again is 086 8962 665. You can also email insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. That email address is insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. And you need to enter before 12 noon on Friday the 30th of April. And you will find the answer to the programme, to the question, if you listened carefully to the programme. That's all we have time for on this week's Inside Education. You can listen to podcasts of previous programmes on www.insideed.com. or on iTunes. You can contact the programme with comments and suggestions to insideeducation@dublincityfm.ie. Thanks to Susan Parks from Trinity College and to Barry Hennessy for the education news. Until the same time next week, this is Sean Delaney signing off. Thank you for listening.